Even Mr. Vortex.
Mr. Vortex, yeah, exactly.
All right.
Got nominated for Twister, didn't win the Oscar here, but I got the BAFTA. We won the British Academy Award. Smarter. So I went there, it was really fun, actually. Star Trek First Contact here. So, that was the movie I was on after Twister, and worked on yet another never-before-seen space anomaly for Star Trek, namely the vortex, the Borg Time Warp vortex, speaking of vortex. Also worked on the rocket liftoff shot with that exhaust that was computer-generated. I was actually the CG supervisor for the show, so do a lot of it. I like to do hands-on work as well as supervise, because I think that way you know what you're talking about.
Right.
You stay. I have to stay creative or I'll die. My background's illustration. I guess all my artwork up here and there. Here's some my like Jimmy look-alike. This is a sculpture. Her head broke. This is her before her head broke. She's made of porcelain. Oh, that's my first programming course. Fortran cards.
Oh,
wow.
Yeah.
Ooh,
oh, yeah.
I just, you know, that's like a shrine of...
I get a kick out of
that. The year after that, they replaced that room with Macintosh. Uh-huh. So, we can get into this stuff. So, having had that unusual, weird background of all these weird effects, whatever, it's kind of a good setup for trying to do things like the cape. And I'd written my own cost simulation software way back before coming here for some fire effects. Are you guys familiar with the Seagraph footages?
Mm-hmm.
There's a skeleton which had Ice-T's voice, and he would, yeah, his feet were on fire, and he held a fireball, and he was like, you know, kill it and feel it, practice with it. Skeleton, and I was doing the fire effects using that software.
Was that from a video? Was that from a music video?
No. It was just on the Seagraph.
Oh, okay. Like a demo.
The electronic theater. That was a year ago. So anyways, that was a kind of a proper background. I worked with John Nolan and actually implementing that code for a Deep Space Nine episode where there's a space sailboat.
Oh, yeah, that was actually really impressive. I remember that, yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
So that was the same code. So I implemented the plot stuff within Dynamation, this package that we have.
So that you used some of the stuff from the Deep Space Nine episode was like a reference to this or whatever? Is that what you're saying?
That was my own software.
Right.
But I took what I know there and implemented a different cloth altogether within the Dynamation package using that knowledge.
I'm sure somebody already told me this on a separate page of it. But Dynamation is an ILM
enterprise. But it's a really powerful tool, and you can plug in your own stuff. So essentially, it's a toolbox. And we have like 10 pages of turbulence for this thing to put in. And there's actually some Twister turbulence in there too. He comes down from the ceiling. He unwraps using. He gets help from a vortex field to unwrap his kit. But this is a particular scene I was talking about where, you know, he's just on the cross. This is the last shot in the film. And the fans went nuts apparently in the previews.
When you shows with this, do you ever ask fans what their census is made of? Because I know that it's supposed to be right on the like borderline between co-op and metal, right?
Right.
This is one of the things that people can comment on.
Throughout the results of the previews, one of the things they really liked was the tape, because of all the things, other things they can do. It can turn into like, it turns into a wall and camouflages them, or turns into bike armor, or it does all these different things. But the reason it looks so bright is that when this red goes to film, it gets really dark. It just practically goes away. But it gets this luminescent quality to it that makes it kind of surreal. And one of the things that I was talking about in this shot was instead of red cape and a blue plate, as an example, is one of the lighting things you have to worry about. In this case, by having a really strong blue edge light, that's the only way I got to pull that off. That's something that helped me, because this was like the initial test of putting a red tape on a blue thing. If you light a red thing with blue light, you get magenta, or it's black. So these are early tests. Then finally using blue light that's basically 20 times brighter than you think it should be. Let me show you some now.
So did you test all these things like in some sort of weird low resolution version?
Yeah, I'm going to show you just that. We're working it backwards from the other, because I showed them sponsors and it looks like when we do, basically the technique is procedural animation, and it's, a lot of people think the computer does all the work and you push a button, but to me it's harder than regular animation, character animation, because unlike feature animation where, unlike character animation where you can actually directly tell a computer where the limbs should go at a certain frame, what you can't do that in procedural animation because there's too many things to set. In this example, 8,000 points, you know. And if you want to do clock animation, you'd have to go and shape 8,000 points every frame. Or in Twister, you'd have to move 5 million particles. So you have to come up with guidelines and rules of things that determine what happens to this, and then let the simulation software do its thing, look at the results, and then keep making the changes that you think you have to make. So it's like animating with a dartboard, where you indirectly have to affect something by putting different forces in it. So here you can see each yellow point is the value.
Hey Mark! He's a genius, this guy right here.
Yeah. Good work, man. Each yellow point is basically how free that point is, and these are hand assigned, each one manually, so that to determine how free that cloth is. So you can see it gets darker as it gets closer to him, because we want those points to be more close to him and not a little bit. But imagine running 80 takes of this every day, 80 simulations. It's like a little wind tunnel in your desktop, and you keep changing, and you have 200 knobs. And you keep changing things and looking at it and say, okay, maybe more turbulence, maybe less this, more that, and all trial and error. some images from developing it as far as the models and the detail. And you can see the iterations of textural details and what we had to do to match the real guy. And this is without color mask. He's incredibly dense and detail because we knew how to handle on far away shots. Talking about muscle over skin technology, we would build the muscles and work out this new software that lets the skin slide over it. Other things I dealt with was like the look of the materials that he has made up, and in this case like darkening areas that are grooved. Like if you spread mud on something and wipe it off, that's kind of what the real suit has. You can see here the difference before and after going through the darkness. And let me show you on the wireframe. Couple of hundred pieces. 300-400 pieces basically frame by frame he gets evaluated on the computer based on the keyframe. He's hand animated most of the shots, otherwise he's motion captured. This is his high-res model here. This is a list of, for example,
what's an example of a piece?
So I can show you, for example, the pectoral right here. That's the muscle piece or something like that.
Right. How many pieces of stone was that?
This is, he's roughly like a but you can see he's so dense you can't see through the wireframe.
Can I ask another stupid sounding question? How do they determine what the basic unit, like one piece is? How do you know that you aren't drawing it too big?
We use like one unit, because a unit in the computer could be anything. We just tell ourselves a unit is a foot. Okay. So then everything's built on that basis. and then we put things in, like, you see these bell pieces that connect to the top piece? We build things that try and automatically deal with that, like what the belt would do, and then if the Android's unlucky, they can adjust that.
Yeah.
Laborious from the process of building him and then deal with how his skeleton, you know, makes a really interesting combination of this dirty, grimy, slimy character that matches, has to match the live action, and also effects like this. That is for real.
What project are you after?
Potentially the first Star Wars prequel. Massive show.
Well, I can imagine, yeah.
There's another show that might happen. So it's always, the challenges I get are always more imaginative than I could have thought of. And that's the challenge for me, is someone has and I'm like, you know, and there's always constraints to go with it. You know, it has to be this, it has to be that. This and this, you know, pieces. This color, that can help you get your goal. Because if you don't have any constraints, you're just going to be endlessly wandering the universe. So I think we achieved a lot of good results with this, you know, they can't touch base on it because of his armor going up and down. And frames on film if you want to look at it.
Okay, good job.
Thank you.
Is everyone hungry?
Oh yeah.
The creation of special effects, what those might look like, and what, you know, what we'd love to see, or and how different. Two questions. Yeah. How different?
Was it from the comic book?
How different was it from the comic book?
Well, so the first thing is we met Todd and Vertigan. We became friends first, then we decided to do the movie together. So we began developing this around 63, long way from the translation process of anything to the screen has always got complications. And a comic book has its own special limitations. One of the problems with the Spawn character visually, and the Violator too, is two-dimensionally you can cheat everything. When you build it three-dimensionally from all angles, it has this reality. I'll give you a simple example of the Violator. We made some design changes to the Violator, and it's very successful. It's a really wonderful feature. It's essentially the Violator in the comic, but in the comic, the Violator is dropped all the way along. What that means is his mouth is always open. So to deal with that, we actually added a feature to the Violator. Todd loves. He drops it in the back, depending on what he's doing with his head. So that's a simple example. Now, Spawn is the hero, and I did a lot of stuff with Spawn, idea-wise, and Todd loved it all. I wrote the original story, which the screenplay is based on. Todd is I ran everything by Todd. But I sort of extended the powers of his suit, in a sense, back in those early days, because a certain, let's say, visual difficulties I had with the basic concept of how Spawn would operate in the real world. For example, Cape. Cape is a very strong element of Spawn. But I didn't want to have Spawn wonky around like Dracula or like Darth Vader with cape trailing. It's just not an acceptable image of what Spawn character is. He's a very dynamic, graphic character. So the cape always had to be alive and have movement of its own. That already presents you with this big complication. How the hell do you do that? You got a guy that's wearing Spawn suit and Spawn makeup. How do you put a cape on his body that's always moving? Well, either you have thousands of special effects just to do that, or you add these features to the cape where it retracts and extends as needed. So those are simple examples. So I did that with Spawn. And in fact, Todd loved that idea, and as the comic developed, there became issues where Spawn didn't have a cape. His cape on. He began exploring that itself visually.
Something came out of the film where he might change his.
Oh, yeah, I mean, Todd's he's a brilliant artist and storyteller, and we would jam a lot on ideas. What does Spawn do? What are his powers really? How far can they go? And he was open to lots of things. I mean, it was actually a very fun process to work with Todd, and he was open to anything that was cool. That was basically the parameter. So, for example, in the movie we use. Did you show him? What did you show him?
Trailer? Big rock reel? RV sequence?
Okay, so for example, in the trailer you saw the motorcycle covered by the cape. Mm-hmm. And it transformed. That's something you wouldn't see in the comic book. But I mean, at the beginning, now you will see that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So we extended the cape in a very natural way. Not only is it a living thing that can that can strike out or be visually reflect his emotions. It can also protect him or be used as a defensive and offensive weapon, in a sense. Mm-hmm. Just like a chain that is spikes and blades. So there's tons and tons of things. It depends on how late the comic you get into. But yeah, the movie, in a lot of ways, his powers got extended in certain directions and were changed. And the behavior of his suit, we emphasize the idea, well, one of the things that really appeals to me about the character is his suit is a living organism. It's a neuroparasite, we call it. And it's connected to his nervous system and all these things that are going on. So I took that idea and just went with it because it's a really interesting one. It's this symbiotic thing that's related on your emotions and your state of mind, your instinctual responses, it will transform and do things. I just took that idea farther than it was. And so it's one of the, I think, very essential elements as well.
Is there anything you weren't quite satisfied with? It's not quite...
Every minute of every day.
Well, yeah,
it's never quite what...
Well, what Clint's sort of saying, it's a tough thing, you know. You basically, like making a movie, you spend a couple hours doing a shot, and you just got to stop or you're going to, like, blow everything. But you never are done, really. You just get to a point where it works, and you're happy. Mm-hmm. But, like, post-production, we've been working... We'll work until the very last day. And every day we come up with new things that can... add something to the movie. But the movie, you know, I would say overall I'm very pleased. It's very strong and achieved a lot of what I hoped for. Really. So I'm very happy and I feel very lucky about that. Because making a film also is sort of a chaotic process. It's like you unleash this beast and you're kind of riding it, you know? It's like a fucking bronco. And if you're lucky, you stay on.
It's like a painter with his art. He's never happy with his work. The difference is ours is a business, and you have no choice. It's still an art form. The business is driving us.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's what I meant. After your 2 hours are up, they pull the plug. So you better get something you're going to be happy with.
That movie's got to come out August 1st from Hell or High Water. No choice.
What you got
in it. That's part of the inspiring process of filmmaking, too. It isn't as single-minded as a painting canvas, meaning it's under your total control. There's a lot of other people involved, forces of nature involved a lot, weather, location limitations, all this stuff. So it really is like making what you have work is a big part of the physical process.
I think Mark's great is, I mean, I'll tell him all day long that we can't work on this any longer. You know, it's got to be, and he's relentless. And the good news is that at the end of the day, you know, his vision prevails, then the movie's going to be that much better. So it's really hard. It's hard to give up stuff when you know it can be better. It's really difficult. Unlike the artist who doesn't really have to give it up, Mark oftentimes has to give it up earlier than he really wants to because there's no choice. So it's difficult. It's difficult. It's giving up your baby, you know. It's hard. You got to do it every day.
I mean, like, I think you're asking what some of the hard stuff is. Another example is that you're working hard on things and you just have no choice. You hit a brick wall. Like, it took too long to shoot some sequence on the exterior of the building or something like that. So now you've got to change the original idea, which is very clearly laid out. All these shots, all these different cameras. On your feet, you have to change it. And then you have to remember how that affects everything else. And it's a big puzzle, you know?
So, you know, we've been working on individual shots at Island for 30 weeks. Mark and I have been working on this project full-time, 7 days a week for a couple of years. And so, you know, in the 11th hour, you have to give up something that you know could be better to make a mix, you know? Can be a very, very painful process to live through. But you know,
that's what makes some people ask MPA questions. I mean, I don't know how much you got into it, but that's an example where this movie really was crafted with that consciously, and then at this point having to deal with these very arcane and cloaked arguments as to what, because the boundary between what is acceptable obviously floats conveniently depending on who the parties are involved in and the winds and in the country or whatever.
The line, "Hey Wanda, how about a little ahead?" It's definitely not a PG-13 line, and we accept that, so we'll change that. But there's other things that are definitely, you know.
You're going to change it.
We have no choice.
We're being forced. I mean, as an example, Jim Carrey can say that all the time. So this is the kind that really bugs the shit out of me, actually, if I must say so.
But in our,
line is going.
Line's gone, yeah. It'll be, "Hey Wanda, what do you think about my little head?" or something. Yeah.
So he could get away with it and still get the PG.
Oh, definitely. If you go, this is, see, what's interesting to me this summer, I don't want to get on a big bandwagon, but, and actually in MPA, I don't blame them because all they're trying to do is make sure the parents of America don't give them too much shit. I mean, not only parents, but also creative people in general, because both sides can complain. We can complain. So they're just trying to make sure they minimize, I think their principle is minimize the number of complaints. I respect that. That's the deal. But you can see how that boundary shifts based on perceptions of, well, this guy, everyone knows he's making films for kids, so it's okay for him to do things that where there's blood and people dying and their heads ripped apart. Now these guys, they make a movie about this character that he went to hell. Now, they can't have any blood. You know, there's these strange kind of, I think, perceptions that really influence their opinions about that. Because like for example, the sequence you saw is probably the most directly violent, but it's all fantastic. It's very consciously created that way. And I think, in my mind, I have no problems with that because it is about a struggle between mythological forces. It's not about the brutality towards human beings. It's about the struggle about good and evil and how human beings become caught between the two larger forces.
That's a kind of a question. Who do you see as the audience for this film, and would you differentiate it in any way from the audiences for, let's say, Batman and Robin, just because it's another comic book film, so well, it's the obvious comparison?
Yeah, I mean, the audiences bear a lot of similarities. I mean, it's a wide-ranging. I think it could appeal to a lot of different people. It might appeal to boys and girls. I would say the difference of Spawn is that, let's say, to compare it to that type of film, it's definitely a spectacle. It's definitely got a lot of special effects, and it's wild and crazy. But the look and feel is a little more edgy or gothic.
I think one of the points of the question is there a different audience for a film that's, you know, a franchise and based on a mainstream, if we can use that word comic, and Spawn is kind of an underground
favorite. It is true, but you know,
That's true.
I mean, as soon as the toys came out,
See, that's one of the reasons that we all agreed that PG-13 was appropriate. The audience for Spawn, I mean, when it first came out, was probably older teens and adults. Now that it's become, I mean, it's a phenomenon that really is widely read, and the readership now is kids, the whole nine yards, and the toy line extended the awareness down to quite young children.
100 million comic books is definitely not long.
Yeah, it's a big thing. It's awareness among young people, to relatively young, is quite high.
Actually, we were astonished when we first started previewing the movie. We had hoped to try to recruit people who didn't know Spawn, and what we found out from the market analysis people was that they couldn't find, if you didn't know about Spawn, you weren't cool. So we had a really hard time finding people who didn't know about Spawn in our demographic, you know, males, you know, 12 to 21.
Right.
When was Spawn first published?
1992.
Late 1992. How long
ago? He quit Marvel and then too.
Yeah. And then he made up his own.
Yeah, that's quite a phenomenon. He and probably the hottest artist there. They all left before his film became very successful.
They all quit. Six people quit October 1992, all at the same time.
So one of the other things you mentioned is that you can't call hell hell in the movie. Is that like another MPAA thing?
No, not specifically. You know, we have a problem with our movie because overall its violence level is too severe. So when you watch the movie overall, it's too much. So there's nothing specific, but we've made specific choices to not call it heaven and not really refer to hell as hell anymore.
I just think that part of the reaction is this fear of those sort of sensitive ideas to a lot of people.
Basically, what it works is, I mean, if a parent, and that means any parent, thinks that their child or any child, the material in some way is inappropriate, then it's not appropriate.
I mean,
that's the way it is. You know, you can't bite the laws.
I don't know how much Clint told you, but the bottom line, one of the reasons that I found this story very interesting, it's a very moral tale.
Yeah.
And that's really what it is. It's about the cruel choices and cruel fate we all face. And how this guy, in the face of all that, makes the choice. It's a very moral and uplifting story, really.
If we get the PG-13 rating, there will be a director's cut on video. It will be released as a regular.
But you're saying superficially it reads as the complete opposite of morality.
If they don't pay attention to the story, yeah. If they just say, they're not understanding that he's put in a bad place and he's essentially, there's no choice. It's everything he has is taken away from him. So this is, the way I like to think of Spawn as this really dark but very deep and powerful hero is that even though he may be a damned soul, he's going to do good. That's the interesting thing. He doesn't care if he's lost everything. He's not going to ever get anything.
And for me,
he's still going to do the right.
And for me, that's what makes it more appropriate for teenagers and less. I mean, yeah. You know, do you want to see a boat crash, you know, or do you want to go see a movie that's got a little bit of moral, you know, question about it? And then a guy where there's a question he has to make about his soul has been damned, so he's got to make his soul righteous, and he does. I mean, so he does choose good over evil. So at the end of the movie, not only does it have an appropriateness for a kid, but it has a more appropriateness because the kid leaves the movie thinking, hey.
Well, see, but the interesting thing, too, is that, of course, he's filming this on all the mythological levels, but there is this ability for your soul to travel in the world. And so that, in certain mythologies, and that Todd steals liberally from Dante's mind. Liberally. And a lot of people, I don't even know how many young people, realize how directly he's taking all this idea. So there is this notion of redemption as possible. And the other idea I like a lot, that really, that again, we can't get into too much in the movie, only hint at, is really that Earth is this, just like the Greek mythology, it's a model of the gods. And they have their own struggles and their own battle, and we are just caught in the middle. So the angelic side has, it's just like God can be a real mean guy in the Old Testament. You know, all of those ideas are in the Spawn story. It's a really
you said
it's a very good
from Dante's Inferno or from Dante in general?
Yeah, Dante in general, but the Inferno, the whole yeah.
Seven levels.
Yeah, and Mal Bolger, the guy that guards the frozen gate in hell. And all. I mean, all these, he steals liberally. There's an issue where he talks about the different spheres of hell and all that.
Yeah, what's the appropriate age group for this film?
For this film? I mean, maybe if a really young child who isn't ready for fantasy, but definitely, see, in my mind, we've shown it to like 10 to...
We saw the movie with 335 kids, ages 12 to 21. Not one kid had any problem with that movie, nor did they write about it, make any comments about it. I never got the feeling that they were...
Five or six
and that was... The, listen, hold on. That was the R-rated version of the picture. That's not the picture the MPA is looking at. Uh-huh. So that's a much, much more intense version of the picture, like the sequence we showed today, than what the MPA is looking at. The version we have for the MPA is nothing like the version we showed these kids. And they had no problem with it. It's a parent's issue. It's not a kid's issue.
Yeah, exactly. I would say, yeah, young children, you know, they can get very emotionally affected by even Disney films. I mean, you have to make that judgment as a parent. But I would say a typical 10-year-old boy, no problem. None at all. No question.
And the problem
we showed it to a group of girls, just because that's an interesting, to me, that's sort of what you wouldn't expect, like 8 to 13. And they were not. They did not think it was too terrifying. The very young ones did say, I thought it was scary, but I was okay. But none of them were like, none of them went away going being horrified or like they're going to have nightmares. No, it's not like that. In fact, that's why I bring up the idea of mythology. We don't concentrate on these ideas that you will go to hell. It's not trying to preach don't sin. It's really trying to let you understand the tough choices this guy has to make and what he does to become a good person. It's not really a hell and damnation and that kind of thing.
In hammering out the storyline, was it a question of emphasis, what you felt, you know, would love to be able to answer on a big screen when you were looking at what, you know, the artist that originally came up with the layout?
Yeah, well, I mean, for example, in the comic book, every single issue could be a movie. Literally. So, and there hadn't been that many issues done when we began writing the story, but what we decided immediately was to basically make a movie about the origin story. That's basically what this is. This film is essentially the origin and the setup of the Spawn character. Who he is, what's his struggle, and what is the choice he makes. Mm-hmm. That's what the movie just tells. It doesn't get into, I mean, you know, now it's up to issue 60-something, and there's 100 stories going on. We don't include any of them. Mm-hmm. If you're a Spawn fan, you'll notice a few little threads we contain. There's a few, you know, and that was a lot of fun to do.
One example, because I'm not...
Here's one the fans will like. The creator is somewhere in the movie. So there's lots of little things. There are characters like, at the very, yeah, there's a bunch of them. I don't want to give them all away.
That's a good one. There's a lot of them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. God, or you mean
Todd.
Yeah. Make sure.
The creator,
the same thing.
The creator's in every frame.
Yeah, I guess that's one more question I want to ask you really quickly before you swap over, which is just about, I guess, the degree to which, you know, working in effects did or did not prepare you for, you know, being a director, I guess. You know.
Yeah, I mean, working in effects only prepared me in the sense so far as became very familiar with digital filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
I'd done a lot of second unit work and commercial work and that kind of stuff. So I'd done direction before, worked a lot with actors. I would say that the thing about what is happening in filmmaking nowadays is that these technologies we're talking about, computer animation, it's just like a camera, it's just part of the process. So when you're making these kinds of, let's say, complex fantasy films in which characters are not human, in which worlds that you inhabit are not physical, then knowing how to use these kind of cameras is very important. That's what's different about where I come from than a lot of other people. Mm-hmm. But really, in order to do directing, you have to direct. That's all there's to it. Mm-hmm. You have to work with actors, you have to work with cameras, you have to do all this stuff.
Do you have any interest in computer work that is not as fantastic as Spawn, like Marvel's Madness' use of it in
sure.
Something like content?
Yeah, I love all kinds of filmmaking. I'll tell you what attracts me, though. It's the art and the film of the fantastic and surreal, always. I mean, even in terms of static art. So in terms of film, the kind of way that we talk when we're hatching ideas is we want to make movies that not only that we want to see, but that we've never seen before. And that doesn't mean it's all about monsters. It's just that is a general place we want to go visually and storytelling.
It's interesting, you seem to be about going forward.
Yeah.
And you look at film like Dread, Caligula, and it's like, right. Well, hold on. We'll go back a little bit and let me show you the original magic of film, and that was back in the
Yeah, no, I love all kinds of film.